Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, 2026. In the Gregorian calendar, and the 27th of Nisan, 5786, in the Hebrew calendar. Today is Yom HaShoah, Israel's Holocaust Commemoration Day. We'll get you caught up quickly on how this holiday of remembrance is observed in Israel and share part of an interview that we conducted with Dr. Alexander Nezer, an 88-year-old who survived the Holocaust as a young child in hiding. We also have a couple of news updates for you on the situation as well. Now, let's get to the news. This morning at 10 a.m., the sirens rang out in Israel, but this time it was not to alarm people about incoming missile attacks. It was to bring all movement to a halt and demand of people to think of the 6 million Jews who lost their lives in the Holocaust. Just simply for being Jewish.
People just stop moving.
Amidst the ongoing war with Iran, Israel marks the somber occasion with programs, talks, fireside chats, and of course, with full closures of all stores and restaurants. Things will open back up when the sun goes down on Tuesday evening. All Jewish holidays in the Hebrew calendar are observed from sundown to sundown. I spent the evening in Tel Aviv last night, so that's Monday night, sitting down with Holocaust survivor Alexander Nezer in front of a full audience. The room was packed with internationals, locals, people of all ages. And what struck me most was that this was one of the very few English language programs happening in the city. It was not lost on me that the room was filled because when the event was booked, we had a wartime restriction to keep the room at a maximum of 50 guests. Now that we're in a ceasefire, that rule has been changed, and we were able to bring as many people as could fit in the auditorium. And on the note of the ceasefire, it is still holding, despite high-stakes talks between the United States and Iran having ended without a deal following more than 20 hours of negotiations in Pakistan over the weekend. U.S. officials say Iran refused to abandon its nuclear ambitions, while Tehran accuses Washington of making excessive demands and failing to build trust. President Trump signaled a tougher stance, announcing plans to immediately move toward a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, a critical global oil route. It went into effect immediately. Meanwhile, military tensions do remain high, with continued rocket fire coming from Hezbollah into northern parts of Israel. And there was a Hezbollah attack here in Israel right after the ceasefire was announced last week. And ongoing Israeli operations in southern Lebanon are continuing. IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir elevated the alert status to a heightened state of readiness. He says Israel should prepare for a return to fighting after ongoing U.S.-Iran negotiations collapsed. A breaking piece of news that I just had to include today, it came in right before I went to go sit down in the chair, is totally historic. For the first time in years, Israeli and Lebanese representatives are meeting in person in the United States State Department in Washington, D.C. to discuss relations and moving ahead in this war. Lebanon has been overtaken by Iran's terror proxy Hezbollah for decades now. And this war has brought that issue to a head. Now the Lebanese army has said that they are going to tackle Hezbollah and remove Hezbollah, but they have not. Yom HaShoah falls on a different date each year, according to the Jewish calendar, typically around mid to late April. That's where we are right now. in the middle of April. It coincides with the time when the Allied forces entered and liberated many of the concentration camps at the end of World War II. This year, ceremonies are taking place under heightened security conditions. The official state ceremony was even pre-recorded. And in Jerusalem, the walls of the old city were illuminated with Holocaust remembrance symbols alongside the words, "Remember and never forget." At exactly 10 a.m. Israel time, a two-minute siren sounded across the country. And as it does every single year, everything stopped. Cars pulled over, people stood still, an entire nation paused together in silence. Today, there are approximately 196,000 Holocaust survivors still alive worldwide. The majority live here in Israel, followed by the United States. The youngest survivors are now about 80 years old. Many were born to parents who hid their pregnancies during the war. Most survivors are in their 80s and 90s. Some are over 100. On Monday night, I sat next to an 88-year-old psychiatrist, Dr. Alexander Nezer. There were some moments that I felt tears well up in my eyes. He did not realize that he'd lived through the Holocaust until he started reading into it later on in life when he had already moved to Israel. I'll tell you a bit about his story and then let some of the video and audio play from our talk on stage. The city of Tel Aviv hosted this event, and it was an honor to receive their request to do this interview, and definitely an honor for the Israel Daily News to be called upon by the city of Tel Aviv. Alexander Nezer was born in 1937, and his earliest clear memory is being separated from his family before the age of five, when his father sent him away on what he told him would be a two-day trip. That journey turned into 5 years of hiding, including time spent with non-Jewish Polish families, and eventually in the home of the mayor of Warsaw, where he survived the war in secrecy. He eventually understood that his entire family had been murdered by Nazis, something that he said he came to understand slowly and quietly over time. The woman who saved him is now recognized by Israel as one of the righteous among the nations. Can you start out by telling us the story? Your story, you were 5 years old from your first memory of being in the Holocaust. Can you share with us your story and then we'll ask you some questions?
Yeah. Well, I learned about the Holocaust after it was over. I was too small to experience it physically. I was born in 1937. I'm 88 years now old. I never imagined that I live as long as that, but that's what happened. When I had 2 years of normal living as a baby, and then the Nazis invaded Poland and entered Warsaw, and I lived until I was almost 5 years old with my family in the ghetto. My father was a doctor. He was an assimilate. He defined himself as a Pole, didn't want anything Jewish actually to be in our life. Of course, the Nazis knew better that he is a Jew. They didn't let him to define his identity and exterminated him. And I'm the only survivor of the whole family. I never had brothers or sisters. So I'm kind of special case in terms of family relationships. My parents, especially my father, they were highly educated. They were nothing like, you know, the Jewish Jews which were living in Poland in the small shtetls, the Hasidim. It was a different world. and they were keeping me inside. So my memories of the time that the German occupation were confined to things which happened inside the apartment in the ghetto. And there was nothing terrible there. I never suffered hunger. There was a shortage of food. I remember once a man came and he brought a suitcase and opened the suitcase, and it was full of fish, probably carp. And as a child even, I knew that this is not the regular way to carry fish around in a suitcase. And my mother prepared a lot of fish balls, like I remember, and I hated them. So it's kind of a normal child experience. And there was a big tragedy at home. I don't want to eat those fish balls. And then my father came, and he made a contract with me that one day I will eat the fish ball and the other day I will not eat. So he must have been very enlightened, very in terms of raising children at that time was terribly oppressive, terribly authoritarian. And I was lucky to have that kind of father. And this memory must be real. I never had actually a mother until about 2 or 3 months ago that I all of a sudden, a mother was born to me at the age of 88. I tell you how. I don't have good memories of my mother, but she must be with me all the time because my father was working outside. So, for instance, I knew very well reading and writing in Polish, but I can't remember ever learning it. So it must be very early that my mother probably learned me this. And since I was very, very small, I developed this identity of being a very talented, very gifted child. About my mother, Tirza, my spouse, was kind of offended when I told her this, that I never had this mother, and she said, you must have something, mother is mother. And I say, I'm sorry, but I suppose that one of the reasons is that I did have a mother figure. It was the woman who adopted me and who saved me. I belong to one of the few, not many, children of Jewish origin who survived the Holocaust in care in the hands of a non-Jewish family, of Christian family. My first identity, my first I am, who I am, was a very nationalistic Polish and Catholic, devout Catholic. Today I am not a believer in any religion, but I know where it comes from. I experienced being religious as a small child. So this Polish woman was the woman which I loved like my mother. I remember the warmth of her body, and I was completely devoted. Only in quite recent years, I happened to be a psychologist, it occurred to me that she was not psychologically my mother, because mother is something which is unconditional, always. The child could be a criminal and still his mother is his mother. And I knew that I'm not a real son, and I developed a tendency to prove to her, to the rest of the world and to myself, that I am worthy of her and their sacrifice. Because I knew even then that if it became known that this family saved me, they would kill everybody, the Germans. So in this way, although I didn't experience directly terrible things in the Holocaust, it influenced my whole life. I have to be worthy of those wonderful people who rescued me. I became an impossible idealist the rest of my life, until recent years. Is there anything which you feel I should add to this description?
Yes. I'd love for you to take us through the day that your father came to you and told you that you were going to go on a 2-day trip.
Yeah, you know that story.
I know about that.
Okay. actually, I might say that my life began at this day. This is the first day which I remember distinctly. They told me that the woman would come and take me to a trip for 2 days in the countryside. And I imagine today that as a child who was closed inside, it was a big thing for me. I was looking forward to her. I wanted to come with her. So they managed to spare me the trauma of separating from my parents. And so it came to pass. At that day, when this woman came again, I don't remember my mother. Probably, and this is only my later supposition, she couldn't bear it. And they were afraid that her anxiety would be felt by me and I would not be relaxed and I would not go with this woman. But I remember my father sitting me on his knee, my special orientation was very good even then. I remember it was on this side, on the right hand knee, I was sitting like here, and he told me, jak ktoś ci powie przeżegnaj się, zrobisz tak. To mówię, żeby polonić. I myślę, jak idę, a ty chcelej, tak to się. Uli mej do ty nie chcelej. And ci jej do ty, oj, sorry, I shifted to Hebrew. He gave me the equipment for life. He equipped me with what I must need in the other side, on the Aryan side, on the Goy side of the ghetto. So this woman came, and the next place was another apartment, and there I got my real trauma. I looked at the mirror there and I looked a little monster. They didn't tell me anything and they cut my hair. I was a ginger, I was a redhead, reddish and curly, and this was not a good sign for a Pole. It was a rather Jewish stereotypic feature. So they shaved me completely for zero. And until after the war, I didn't know what kind of hair if I have, never knew it. I was, as a Catholic, I was hairless completely. But I saw myself and I remember bursting into terrible crying. They cheated me. They did something against my will. And for the rest of my life, it followed me not to do to my children, to any person, something without telling them, without a cover-up of truth always, in the final analysis, it would be hurtful. If you have children, if you have need to do something real that is not pleasant for them, don't do it against their will, because it would ruin the basic trust between people. And then the next stop was another woman in another apartment. I remember her standing in front of me, and since I was a little child, I also remember passing the gates of the ghetto into the other life. I remember the German gendarme, with his characteristic helmet, steel helmet, on the right hand side, and I was holding the hand of this woman, and we passed. Under what pretext, I have no idea. I know that there was an organization of Hasidei Umot Olam, how do you say it, the righteous among the nations. Her name was Irena Sandler, and she took care with some other women to take children out from the ghetto, and mostly they placed them in monasteries, in convents, and I don't know, but we passed this and we were on the other side. And then on the other side, I remember standing on a bed, probably like cradle, a bed on which children stand with a barrier, and this woman standing in front of me. If I had a camera, I could picture her. She was very stout, with a big breast, and holding a big
loaf.
Bread in her hand, and the other hand, even tremendously big, how it looked to me, knife, ready to cut, to slice a slice of the bread. And she said, repeat after me. And she repeated each sentence of the Pater Noster, our Father that is in heaven, you know, the popular daily prayer of the Christians. And I repeated after her, and after I said Amen, she cut a slice of bread and gave it to me. It's not the end of the story. The story became my worst trauma of the Holocaust. When I woke up in the morning, I felt a nice warm feeling at the lower side of my belly. I pissed in the bed. I wet my bed, and that became my trauma, because in the educational theory in mind of Catholics at that time, it was my fault. God was punishing me, probably because I was not praying enough devotedly or did something bad, and it was terrible. I cannot express it in words, but the total feeling of helplessness, you can nothing I can do about it. And so that was on the same day. Transferred me to another family, which was much better. And then finally, they took me in a truck, in a cabin of a truck next to the driver I was sitting, and we were driving quite a distance. And then we stopped, and a woman came, and she told me, I know your father, he was my friend. You will call me Auntie Zosia, and your name will be Andrzej, which is the Polish for Andrzej or Andrew, Pashnik, and do not tell anyone what was your name before her, or that you were in the ghetto. And that was that. She was this my Polish mother. I cared very much for my memories, my few memories, being real, not being fabricated by later events. How is it possible that the Poles had a truck at that time? There were no automobiles in that little town to which they brought me. There were horses and buggies, even in the big cities. And Germans did not allow Poles to have trucks. So some years ago, I received a message from a young man in this little town in Poland who became interested in the Jews of that town. The name of the town, this is my hometown, my Shangri-La, my place which I, as a child, wanted back because it was my only place, my mother and so on. He became interested in the Jewish community at this time. When I was there, I didn't know that there were Jews in that little town. And Jews were the majority of this town before the war. I didn't know that. At that time, it was after the communism, the regime of the Soviet Union was dismantled, and Poland became independent, and they developed a very effective archive of everything Jewish in Poland, all names, and there were a lot of documents there. But in this case, this young man interviewed an old man who was living there, older than me, and he remembered, and I asked him, please ask him whether that was possible, that somebody brought me with a truck. And he said, yes, there was one man there who was a Volksdeutsche, was ethnically German, but he was anti-Hitlerist, anti-Nazi. You understand? And he had a car, he had a truck. So my memory, I got a confirmation.
Now that you've heard more details about Dr. Nezer's early life, we did also record a later section of the event where I asked about anti-Semitism. And let's just say that the crowd was not expecting to get the answers that they did. Let's play some of this. It's a little controversial for today's Israelis to reckon with. So I know that you feel that if you look for anti-Semitism, you'll find it. But we're seeing it very much right now. And just a couple of days ago, there was a big burning of an effigy of Netanyahu in a small town in Spain, which is something that people have done in the past in Europe to you know, make Jews a minority and to make them look like they're bad and to bring up all of these anti-Semitic tropes. And so we're seeing sparks of anti-Semitism. We're seeing violence against Jews. Places like the United States of America, where Jews felt that they were safe and secure, are becoming violent and becoming places that Jews don't want to live. So what is your message today as anti-Semitism is rising, and not just because we're looking, but because it's really happening?
As far as I got it, anti-Semitism, it's not exactly anti-Semitism, it's anti-Israel. Netanyahu is in burning the effigies of Netanyahu. It's not because he's Jewish, it's because he is a prime minister of Israel. He is the leader of this country. So much of what what is resistance to Israel and to the wars of Israel and the occupation and the violence against others is not anti-Semitism. It's something else. It's tragic. It's terrible that people see in Israel the kind of a monster country, power. And Jews, anti-Semitism was always against the weak, against the minorities. That's what I say.
As a journalist, I like to make sure I get myself out of the way, let people talk and share, and make sure that all the ideas and thoughts are out there. Many guests came up to me after the event and shared that they thought perhaps his trauma was keeping him from seeing the anti-Semitism that is clear and present in front of us today. Either way, I think Dr. Alexander gave us a lot to think about. And I encourage you all to continue in your Holocaust commemoration today and maybe read something that you've never read before about the Holocaust. All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, 2025. Tel Aviv has a low of 14 degrees Celsius and a high of 23 degrees. That's 58 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 74 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, with a personal note from me at the top, you can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in so that you can get on the mailing. Have a great and productive day and an excellent week.